I'm Bronwyn Williams, futurist and trained analyst, and this is Local Logic, where we help South Africa's technology leaders unlock the real power of data and AI in their technology stack. Join me as I sit down with Dr. Bongani Andy Mbaso, CTO of Altron Group, on building secure data and AI-driven digital transformation. Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron, because local expertise drives global results. Hello and welcome to Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron. Today we are joined, as always, by the CTO of Altron, the Altron Group, Andy Mbaso. And today our guest expert is Rich Mulholland, the founder of Too Many Robots. And our conversation today is going to focus on how you can actually get that elusive return on investment from your experiments and dabbling in the world of AI. So, Andy, maybe we should start with you. What do you think the biggest challenges are that businesses are facing when it comes to actually getting return on investment for investment into AI technologies?
I think people are trying to solve for the hype that is AI, trying to go with the futuristic, maybe even the science fiction, and then wondering why, you know, POCs don't yield the results that they're expecting. I think we've made the point a few times on the podcast. I think the best use cases that have yielded ROI are those that have been determined with a specific output or an objective, right? Mm-hmm. Like improving customer experience, you know, just making delivery to a customer faster, making the product more cheaper, etc. So for me, I like to say that the fundamentals of business have not changed, and customers should always be focusing on what is it that can make, you know, my product or my delivery to my customer just better than the next person, and then focus on that. So I think that's why they fail, is that a lot of, you know, AI experiments and use cases are actually just focused on fluff. You know, there's a lot of fluff projects. Slop projects, right? You know, people are just working on stuff. But if you ask them, can you connect it to something that you're trying to achieve? That's when it starts to get a little bit difficult. Yes, I understand experimentation for the sake of learning, but if that's the case, and let's state it like that to go, we need X amount of time and space to experiment and learn. But if you're experimenting for the sake of an outcome or a customer objective, then you need to be very clear what that objective is.
What you're saying there really echoes with a lot of recent research that's come out. There's like that MIT study that everyone's buzzing about all over the interwebs, talking about how like 80% of enterprise AI deployments have failed. And that opens up some interesting points because we can look at this from different directions. If you are talking about these large-scale deployments that are focused on the noise or the fluff, as you call it, rather than on real returns, if you are an AI skeptic, you might be saying, oh, well, there you go. Clearly, this is a waste of time and energy. But when you scratch a little bit deeper into the surface, you start to see that even if big projects that have been deployed in the wrong direction have failed or underperformed according to, you know, enterprise goals, we're still seeing adoption of AI on the fringes that seems to be unstoppable, growing, and actually showing returns for individuals on the edges. So small versus big is, I think, something I'd like you to come in on, Rich. And that is, what is the difference between deploying, going after the big thing versus going after the small things? And what wisdom can you add to the conversation for business leaders who are looking for the right point to start investing in these sorts of technologies? Where are people getting it wrong by going after the big things too fast? And where are they, conversely, getting it wrong by being too slow to go for the small, low-lying fruits?
Yeah, I think that what there is a potential versus readiness gap that exists, that everybody's chasing the potential. So the promise of AI is massive, what it promises that we can do in business. And so you have business leaders who are sitting looking and thinking, well, what is the big thing? What is the big swing that we can take to really fundamentally change our business? But there are two problems with that. One is their data readiness. Their data is not ready to make that swing. It was built for a different era. The operating system that they are using, that data was built and operates within, is for a different era of computing altogether. And then the second thing is the culture of the people in the organization. So people aren't ready to make those changes because people are afraid. So what we need to do, the advantage of small swings here, is that you both are working with a smaller set of data, so it's easier to manage and control, but also you're giving people, in their own domain areas, you're giving people a reason to believe and a reason to trust this. It's saying, hey, look how this tool can make you better, and as such, make the organization better. And so I think that organizations need to stop thinking about AI strategy and maybe be thinking about this in the short term tactically.
Andy, do you want to come in there in terms of honing in on some of those tactics that you can give businesses advice on?
Yeah, 100%. And I think you made such an important point earlier, Bronwyn. For me, I liken it to the internet. So before we get to the tactics, the fact that there's a groundswell where people are actually adopting AI, employees are adopting AI with or without the organization moving fast on this or making decisions on this, right? It's very similar to the internet. Where did you see the internet first make a big impact? It was the individuals. It was the people suddenly connecting to the internet on their laptops, etc. And small companies were born in that era, right, that really leveraged the internet before the big guys really figured out what it is that they need to do. So for me, that's actually a good sign to show that actually there's something here that will be transformational. I think it might take some time for people to really find those real use cases that will drive their businesses forward. But like the internet, AI is a foundational technology. You know, what did the internet bring us? It brought us search, right? That's the killer product. It brought us social media. It brought us, you know, proper, you know, web-connected email, real-time chat, e-commerce, you know, internet banking. All of these things were all the products that you can now suddenly launch on top of this foundational technology called, you know, internet. And I think it's very similar with AI as well. AI is not the solution, it is the tool. And what are some of the fundamental things that it can enable, right, for a business? And I think if you talk to, you know, some of the tactical type of things, you know, I talk about things like, how do you make your call center response times lower, right? Because every customer is frustrated with, I'm trying to get, you know, something resolved, it takes way too long. How do I reduce that time? Right? That's a very tactical thing that can have a tangible impact on your customers and their experience. Another example is just, how do I get my approval processes to move faster, right? So can I leverage this foundational technology to make me move faster as an organization? Because if I'm faster, I can deliver value to my customers a lot more quickly. So I think for me, that's one of the examples of some of the tactical things that people can do. And I think as we embed those tactical things, some of the big and more transformational things will become a lot more obvious, right? And we can have the courage to be able to take them on. I think too often we go for the big and transformational too early. Yes, I'm a big vision guy. I always have a big vision, but be pragmatic about how you roll that out, right? I think I call it the organizational change capacity. Sometimes you can have a vision that's so big and bigger than your organizational's ability to change that you can actually break the organization. So you need to find a way to almost stretch it slowly so that it becomes a new norm and keep going. And then you get to a point where you can now tackle some of the bigger, more transformational projects.
I think you raised some really interesting points, especially around the trap of focusing on the big rather than the important, the big that often blinds us to perspective, both in terms of optimists and pessimists in this field.
Yeah.
I like the way you drew the analogy between the early days of the internet. I'm seeing many people right now pointing to the current, obviously, tech explosion or the stock explosion and the numbers going up perhaps a bit too fast on the stock market and saying we're heading for a bubble, and there's analogies towards the dot-com bubble in the 90s. But if you're pointing to those analogies and saying this proves that AI is unimportant, you're missing the point, because the dot-com Correct. Bubble was just about chasing the big too soon
Correct.
And the transformational change came later. And I think that would be an interesting point to bring you in there, Rich. And something that you said in the lead up to this conversation, that AI is not the elephant, it's a means to catching the elephant. Those are really interesting words. Would you like to color them in for us?
Yeah, so I get frustrated when we chat to people in organizations and they want to talk about their AI strategy. I briefly touched on this earlier. And they see AI as the thing. So they want to think big about something. Like AI is a elephant that you can tame. But it's not. What it is there are many, many things. The rules of business have not yet changed. So you still have a finance problem and a sales problem and a workflow automation problem and a call center problem. These are the problems that we need to solve for. Now, what we are seeing is organizations putting in a chief of AI strategy. And so what we've created is a bureaucratic layer that says what can and cannot be done in an organization. When in fact, the proper use of, or the best chance you have of deploying AI successfully is federating it and saying, individually, in part of your finance strategy or call center strategy or whatever the case may be, how can you utilize a tool within the category, the toolbox that is AI? Because AI is not a thing. It is a method of an underlying technology supporting many things. So how can you use that specific tool to do that? And we should have federated AI strategies or tactics inside the strategies of the departments of our business, not an overarching one, because that will slow down everything. What we do need, though, is somebody to make sure that the data is ready and you know, properly aggregated. And then we do need to make sure that there is some governance, that we're not going to be complete cowboys here. Yeah. But other than that, I think we need to let departments run their own affairs.
Great advice. Andy, back to you. In terms of readiness, Rich has made that point very clear. You need to be ready first. If your AI deployment strategy is aligned to your business strategy, aligned to your strengths, your understanding of your weaknesses, you're obviously going to have a much better chance of deploying the right technology at the right time to solve the right problem. But that sounds easy, but it's a lot harder than that. So what is your advice when it comes to businesses assessing whether they are ready or not to take on these technologies, or if they're going to end up in those MIT statistics on the 80% of people who get it wrong, rather than the 20%, which we really want to focus on, of the people that get it right, which is a pretty classic adoption curve, incidentally. Right. How do you make sure you're going to end up on that 20% side of the curve who are going to be the big winners here? And I know you've got some ideas around AI readiness assessments, and maybe you want to just take us through some of that advice.
And you know, so thanks for that question, Bronwyn. And part of the reason why we developed it, you know, the AI, you know, readiness assessment was because of that, right? Customers were moving too quickly to let's do the big and the bold and, you know, just the, you know, the amazing, which we want. But often you can miss some of the fundamentals along the way, right? I think if you start at a tactical layer, it minimizes how many things you have to have ready so that you can prove value, right? Minimize the time to value, because that builds confidence into the system, and then you can do a little bit more. The system has enough capacity to do a little bit more, and so on it goes, right? So that's part of the reason why we developed that. We want to start with the question, what problem are you trying to solve? So be very specific about the problem you're trying to solve. And the problem cannot be AI, and the problem cannot be my manager or my CEO or whomever said I must use AI. The problem must be, hey, to reconcile the finances at the end of the month is just too long a process. So how do we reduce that and make it more efficient? You know, that could be an example of a problem. So start at that starting point. Once you're very clear about that starting point, then you can start to look at, okay, well, is AI the right tool that you could potentially leverage, right, to help you solve this thing? Because not always that AI is the answer. So sometimes it is the answer, sometimes it is not the answer. And that's also an outcome, by the way. It is also okay to go, actually, no, we can solve this problem in a classical way. We don't need to leverage AI. So once you've crossed that barrier and you go, okay, actually, we believe that, yeah, there could be some value in automating this with some level of intelligence. So we think AI is the right sort of outcome. Then great. Then we can move on to the next step to go, all right, what are the data sources required to then be able to enable this use case? Then we can look at all the various data sources. Are they clean? Are they accurate? You know, you can ask all of those questions. You know, we've got a data aggregation tool that can help with that. You know, go discover dirty data sources rather, and suggest how you can, you know, be able to kind of clean that and make it ready for that use case. Only then, only when you're at that point, are you then able to then start running your AI experiments. And often we kind of skip that, right, that process, and we go straight to running the experiment.
Great advice. But let's get back to some of those more transformational things. I know you sometimes it does actually work. The big deployments do result in return on investment if they're done with the correct auditing and strategic planning and understanding of where that's a technology could be deployed. And I know, Andy, in your work, you have recently been part of quite a big project for a large bank that has been successful in unlocking large amounts of return on investment. Can you tell us a bit about that? What you did to get it right and what the results were?
Yeah, I think that it's the same basic approach, right? Just scaled at a bigger level. So same starting point. What is the problem that you're trying to solve? You know, how can we assist? You know, are the data sources ready? Where are they? Let's map them out, etc. Just really making, you know, setting yourself up for success, right? Making sure that you've got all the steps really clearly mapped out so that you can start to, you know, start to automate some of the use cases as you go along. I think, you know, the trick for me around return on investment, and maybe this is a good takeaway, you know, for the audience, is return on investment, it can be measured in multiple ways. There's one, can you increase revenue, right? That will be one way to increase ROI. Or two, can you decrease cost? That'll be another way to increase ROI. There are also some non-tangible ways that aren't ROI in the classical sense, like you will get some financial gain, but you know they sort of lead to, you know, your customer feeling better about the organization and potentially them spending more with you, which is around, you know, improving customer experience and the like. So those are some of the examples that, you know, one could look at. So I think it's important to pick which one you're going to use to measure, because how do you know that it's been successful if you haven't chosen the way that you're going to measure it? So that's maybe another thing that we got right, is we went, well, this is actually about efficiency and we're going to measure success in this way. And so we could then decide, hey, guys, actually, we can mark our own homework here because we can see this is the metric that you had before. We've upped this metric to here. I mean, job done, right? Like you've actually managed to do that. I think waiting to define the metrics at the end is sometimes a trap, because then you end up in this situation where someone goes, well, you know, what did you really achieve, right? It's very, very subjective.
And he makes a great point there, Rich, in terms of the two different ways to get ROI, the one cutting costs, obviously, the other way in increasing your value. Cutting costs is a lot about what we've been speaking about. It's the low-lying fruit. It's finding the inefficiencies between departments, between data sets, reducing flows that are sucking up lots and lots of your HR hours and just making your business more efficient. Now, in the short term, that's a short-term win, obviously, and it's something that, unfortunately, in the longer term, will just become best practice. It's not a long-term competitive advantage, but it is something you want to get right faster so you can benefit more from those cost savings for longer. But the other side is perhaps the harder but more important one, talking about those bigger swings that are higher risk but are higher reward. So now I want to talk in a bit in a different direction, which is, where are you seeing people being too timid when it comes to investing in those longer term, bigger strategic plays that are actually going to give you longer term competitive advantage? And again, if you have any real life case studies to speak to, so much the better, but just using your expertise, what are your thoughts on being risky but still wise about taking chances on the future?
So the bad news is I don't think I have a take on that. But I would like to take you back a step, because the presupposition in the after the previous question was that smaller projects don't offer ROI and big projects do. And I don't think that's the case. Mm-hmm. At the end of every single month, for example, with us, we have to present an ROAI. Our business model states if we can't demonstrate ROI, we give you back the difference in your fee. So, and I do believe companies can actually track multiple smaller investments across the road. Where I think companies are getting overly afraid, and I don't have a specific case study, but overly afraid about the statistics, the MIT numbers, the 80% are going to fail, is that if you look at something like Google Brain, right, 80% of Google Brain's projects failed, but the other one turned them into a $4 trillion business. Mm-hmm. And so, and more than solved for everything else. So companies need to take big, interesting swings. And the reality is the ones that win tomorrow will probably be the ones that have. Of course, you know, there's the winners, there's the survivors, and there's the losers. The survivors will be the ones who take all the right tactical swings. The big, big, big winners will be the ones who take the big hits and win. And the losers will be the ones who take the big hits and lose. So there is an appetite for risk that we have to consider. But I do think that people are getting overly scared about this 80% statistic and not thinking about it properly, that the best companies in the world recognize those results and they still operate because they know the value of the 20% can be a game changer.
Well said. And Andy, you've got an example there too, in unlocking real-time customer insights for a large bank here in South Africa and generating literally hundreds of millions of rands in value. So this really backs up what Rich is saying here. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So look, I won't be able to get into the specifics of, you know, of the customer and all of that, but you know, so I'm trying to respect that. But I think the bottom line is this, right? For me, if you say what's big impact, well, big impact is made out of small little impacts that you can then scale up. So I don't think those two things are actually mutually exclusive. I think they're actually one continuum, right? So you kind of have to start with some of the little things to build that organizational change capacity, like I said, and you can measure little ROIs. But once you start to see that there is value here and this is something that can make huge impact, I think for me, what I've seen and some of our customers in FSR, what they've seen is they go, all right, we are now going to take the big swing. Because the early value has been proven, right? We're going to take the big swing. We think this is a big bet for us, and we're going to go ahead. And that's how you ensure that, you know, you can take those big swings while minimizing some of the risk. Risk can never be zero, right? Like anything that you're doing in innovation. But at least you are taking a very measured approach to the way that you are innovating. So it's quite different. I don't think Rich is saying just from, you know, just do a Google search, research some project, and then let's just put 1 billion rand behind that project. It's not what we're saying. What we're saying is start with those small things that can build up to that bigger value case. That's often a very nice way to make sure that, you know, you can convince your board, your exco, etc., to go, let's take this big swing. And we've got some small proof points here that show that we think that there's something here, right? So for me, it's a continuum, right? So you can build it up from some of these smaller value cases and then build it up to this bigger business case as you can go, you know what, we believe now that we've got the right proof points, etc. We think we should put X amount of money. Well, we believe we can get the value. It may not work, but you've given yourself the best chance to make sure that it does work.
Yeah, so as much as we can talk about caution, there's still also the risk of not moving forward and doing something. And Rich, there, I'll come to you because I know you've written many books and you spend a lot of time speaking to people all across the world about how to think about the present and the future and their place in it. And one of your more recent books is around relentless relevance. How do you think that relates to this conversation around being brave but wise about moving forward along with the world around us when it comes to the opportunities available through technology?
Yeah, well, relevance is an interesting word, right? It means being appropriate to the matter at hand. And right now, this is the matter at hand. Today's rapidly disruptive technology is AI. And so we need to be thinking about it. There's absolutely no doubt in that regard. I do think every individual needs to be thinking about it, though. If I was running a really large organization, I would care less about the one big project we did, and I would care more about what percentage of people in my organization are using AI. That's the number I want to check. I was speaking for a large financial services company in Chicago a while back, or maybe 2 months ago, and at one point I asked them to open up, in this case it was ChatGPT, and just to do something we were trying to demonstrate. And these were leaders within this organization, and 80% of them didn't have a paid account. And I thought, how do leaders earning massive dollar-based salaries, how are they not paying for one of the most, they don't have a pro account for one of the most disruptive, empowering technologies that have ever existed? And that's because their company hadn't paid for it. And I think this mindset has to shift. People are making themselves irrelevant. And the other, like, just idea that I've been obsessing over is that companies are getting very upset, or people are getting very upset with AI, because they look at a business of 100 people and they say, well, now we can deploy AI and do the same work with only 50. But I don't think that's what's happening here. I think, you know, entrepreneurs don't want to do less. They want to do more. So what they're doing is they're saying, well, with the same 100 people we have, how much more work can we do? Now, of course, there will be casualties. A lot of call center people seem to be losing their jobs, and there will be efficiencies that will be happening. But for the most part, we need to constantly look at every problem that exists, every matter at hand, and say, what is the best way to solve this with the tools that we have today? And currently, for a lot of those tools, in fact, AI is not necessarily the tool, but it'll always be in the toolbox.
That's a great way to think about it. We cut costs not purely just to cut costs, but so that we have more capacity to invest in developing value. I don't know if you have any...
I wanted to add on that. I mean, I think the people component is so important, especially in large corporates. I'm also with Redshare. I mean, I get surprised with, when people go, I don't use Claude. I don't use Gemini. And I'm like, what do you mean? You know, it's one of the biggest accelerators one could get, right, in their day-to-day jobs and tasks. I think you should be stressing the tool, right, and really getting it to deliver value. Not that you're outsourcing your thinking to it, but you're in control, you're in command, but you're getting it to be your assistant, right, to help you to get through things faster. And I just think, imagine a world where a corporate of 50,000 people are all empowered with AI tools, and the amount of work they could get done and the amount of value they could deliver and create for their customers. I think it's just truly tremendous. So sometimes we also miss that basic use case. Mm-hmm. A lot of times in corporates, these tools are for executives, if they are there at all. And you miss it for the lower level, parts of the organizations who are actually doing the work, right? So I think one simple use case is just that. How am I empowering my workforce with the right AI tools so that they can do their jobs properly? And it's not about cost. It's not about expense. It's about finding the right balance, right? If you think about, earlier in, when we all had to start bringing our phones to work, remember how IT used to kind of go, no, you can't install this. You can't do that. Data is going to leave our organization. I think that's just the new version of that problem, right? Is how do we ensure that customers can bring their own AI tools, can bring their own whatever, but still be able to, control the data, make sure that the policies are clear, the employees know what they can or cannot do, etc. Often it's about training to go, guys, please use it, but be aware of 1, 2, 3. If you leave it silent and say nothing, people are using it anyway. And so, it's about, being in the front foot to say, okay, let me just be proactive and enable my organization. And I think in that way, you'll get a huge amount of gain, which will lift the entire tide of the organization. So, yeah, that's often one use case that's overlooked because we often go for the project-based use case, right? Like a project to do 1, 2, 3, and we forget about empowering our employees.
And missing out on all those easy wins because, of course, the people doing the tasks are the best place to know exactly what part of their day is 100%. Wasted on tasks that suck their time and where they could be better deployed for value, but only if we trust them to do
correct.
It, right?
And they then come up with the best use cases, right, that are scalable to the big swing ones, right? So it's now, it's almost coming from the ground up as opposed to just top down. You need a combination of both, but sometimes, some of the best ideas, like in Altron, for instance, some of the things that we've implemented organization-wide started with just one or two people in a team going, guys, this is working amazing for us. We think that this is something that the organization can be able to adopt.
Have you got anything to add there, Rich, before we wrap this up?
Yeah, I think we have to get heavy-handed and force adoption of this. In my other company, Missing Link, the team just were not. They were not embracing it. And part of the project, when we launched Too Many Robots, I said, you can go to war with Missing Link's clients. Now, I own both companies, but I was so frustrated that the teams were not embracing this technology. So we became a threat to our own organization. I think ignoring these technologies and putting your head under the ground should not be tolerated in organizations. And we need to have policies in place to make sure that people are trying to use the best tools available to them. One of the easiest ways for us to do that at a small scale, but within every micro team in a large bank, every Monday, as part of our huddle, everybody had to share what new thing they did using an AI tool this week. And it didn't have to be, they didn't have to shoot the lights out. It was like a small little efficiency, and what AI wins did they get? And slowly but surely, we built up a culture where people believed that we were an organization that all embraced these tools across every level. It wasn't something that happened at the fringe. And if we don't start trying to culturally build this into our organizations, because AI adoption is not a technological one, it's a cultural one. And if we want to make the organization ready, we have to fix the culture first. I think HR has a big job to play here.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a great way to end this conversation. Of course, it links back to some of the other conversations Andy and myself have had on the show, where, yeah, a lot of the failures when it comes to institutional development of projects are actually people failures, right?
Yeah.
Either people focusing on the wrong problem, or people being fearful of the technology, or people just chasing their own agendas. And of course, not getting the people layer right is going to limit ultimately the return on investment and the actual deliverable of any project you try and take on board. So if you are trying to become part of the 20% who spends their money wisely and ends up with those results that we're all looking for, that the technology definitely has the potential to deliver, start by making sure that you are ready. And that, of course, requires making sure your people, each and every one of them, from leadership right down all the way through the organization, are ready to be part of the change. Well, that's it from myself, Bronwyn, from Andy and Rich, who have joined us today on Local Logic, a technology podcast for leaders, brought to you by Altran. Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altran, because local expertise drives global results.